Are you also tired of one-size-fits-all weight loss plans? Meet Noom, the personalized solution that meets you where you are. Noom is able to understand your unique needs, from dietary restrictions to medical concerns. Unlike restrictive programs, Noom embraces your lifestyle and choices. Discover a sustainable approach to weight loss, tailored just for you. Honestly, Noom felt like it was made for me. It's not just about what I eat. It's about understanding why. With Noom, I've learned so much about myself and built healthier habits that stick. It's all about progress, not perfection. Say goodbye to restrictive diets and experience the Noom app for yourself with personalized lessons and expert coaching. Noom's psychology and biology-based approach has helped over 5.2 million people achieve their goals. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
You're listening to The Dead Prussian, a podcast about war and warfare.
Some of you may be aware of the border war in southern Africa. It ran from 1966 to 1990. Some of you may not be aware of it. It's also known as the Angolan Bush War and was largely an asymmetric conflict that occurred in Namibia, Zambia, and Angola. It was fought between the South African Defence Force and the People's Liberation Army of Namibia, an armed wing of the Southwest African People's Organisation. The South African Border War resulted in some of the largest battles on the African continent since World War II, and was closely intertwined with the Angolan Civil War. That's actually all I know about the war, and that's why I thought it'd be a good idea to talk about someone who actually fought in it. In fact, my guest for this episode commanded troops, revolutionised mechanised tactics in the South African Defence Force, and played a key part in the conclusion of the war. Major General retired Roland de Vries joined the South African Army in January 1963. He was commissioned in January 1964, and he served in various training and operational positions. He commanded, amongst others, the 61st Mechanized Battalion Group, the South African Army College, the 7th South African Infantry Division, and the Joint Training Division of the South African National Defence Force. His operational experience include various military operations in the former Rhodesia, Southwest Africa, and Southern Angola. Some of these operations were Protea, Modular, and Prone, and they were in Southern Angola. He was a major contributor to the development of the Rattal Infantry Combat Vehicle and its subsequent combat system and doctrine during the 70s. His book on mobile warfare, Mobile Warfare, A Perspective for Southern Africa, was published during August 1987 in South Africa whilst he was a colonel. This book outlined his thinking on the development of operational concepts and military doctrine for mobile conventional warfare within Southern African context. He is credited with being the main driver behind these concepts within the Southern African Army. Roland led the transformation team of the newly created South African National Defence Force in 1997 and developed a new integrated leadership, command and management concept for the Department of Defence. In 1997, he was appointed Chief of Joint Training and in 1998 as the Deputy Chief of the South African Army. This role entailed developing a new military strategy for the South African Army, as well as planning and managing the Army's transformation process. He retired as Deputy Chief of the Southern African Army in 1999, and he has published his memoirs, entitled Eye of the Firestorm, in May 2013. Roland, thanks for flying to Australia, and specifically, just to come on my show.
Wonderful, Mick. Thank you very much. It's great talking to you here at Army Headquarters. I feel extremely comfortable here. And it's really a privilege and honour to have a discussion with an officer who is a gunner.
And we do know that gunners are probably the best looking of the officers out there. Now, Roland, you had quite a distinguished military career. What made you decide to join the military in the first place?
Well, when I was still a youngster, of course, we had cadets at school. There was just this thing that I wanted to join the army, and I was dead set on doing that. And at the age of 18, after I wrote matric, I went to the Army Gymnasium in 1963, did a full-blown instructor's course, and then went on a junior officer course and became a second lieutenant in 1964. I didn't want to go to the academy. I wanted to platoon as quickly as possible.
Now today, we're focusing on the border war, which spanned a fair part of your career.
23 years.
That's a long time to be in a force that is at war. And we're currently in a similar time span for the what's called the War on Terror. But can you give our listeners a brief rundown of the border war?
Mick, if you take the 23-year span with regards to the border war, you find an interesting set or subsets of war fighting which happened in the northern border region of Southwest Africa, now called Namibia, and of course southern Angola, where most of our external operations took place. Now, what was interesting, I spoke to some of your students at the Defence Command and Staff College last week, and they studied the South African border war in minute detail. And there was an interesting conclusion that one of your students drew, which I really took to heart, and I think it's important with regards to warfare. He said that was one of the wars which led to peace. Now, think about that. This is what truly happened there during the border war. Now, if you take the South African border war in perspective, we were fighting, there were major conflicts ongoing in Southern Africa on the southern tip of the continent at that stage. We had the war in Angola, which was firstly fought as a liberation war against the Portuguese in 1975, after the coup happened in Portugal and independence was given to Angola, the civil war started. So there was an intrastate war happening in Angola, and of course in Southwest Africa there was the counter-colonial war being fought against South Africa, which were given mandate rights in Southwest Africa after we fought with the Commonwealth forces in the First World War. The mandate rights were given to South Africa at Versailles during the signing of the peace agreements. So we had the struggle, the intrastate war ongoing in Southwest Africa as well. You know, there was the war in Rhodesia, the Liberation War, and then in Mozambique as well. There were ongoing conflicts in that region as well. And the frontline states were all against South Africa, and at that stage we still carried the burden of apartheid. And we were in the process of shedding that because the whole world was against us. The international community, the United Nations, they wanted us to implement Resolution 435 as quickly as possible, which would lead to the democratic processes being embarked on in Namibia to set up a free country in that area. And superimposed on everything was, of course, the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And the Russians and the Cubans. Eventually, there were 55,000 Cubans in Angola participating in their civil war. There were many Russian advisors in Angola, and they were being supported by the Soviet states or by the Soviet Union. So we were sitting with a situation where the South Africans were fighting. They had the internal struggle in South Africa against the ANC and their guerrilla movement, which were referred to as Umkhonto weSizwe. The fighting there was mainly the responsible of the South African police with the South African Defence Force in support. Yeah. And the South African Defence Force was fighting the counter-insurgency war in Southwest Africa. And then, of course, when we developed the warfare further, we were fighting in southern Angola as well. So we were fighting a revolutionary, or let me rather state it as such. There was a combination of war sets, namely revolutionary war being conducted and also the counter-revolutionary struggles being conducted in all those countries by the respective governments in place. And at the level of the military, there was insurgency vis-a-vis counter-insurgency being fought. And then as the war further developed, you found that semi-conventional warfare tactics were being applied in southern Angola, as well as the major conventional battles which took place there during Operations Modulo, Hoopa and Paka in 1987 to 1988. Now, and then on top of that, of course, as I mentioned, was the Cold War, where the Russians and the Cubans played a major role, with regards to the liberation struggle of Angola, and also supporting the Southwest Africa People's Organization, with PLAN, as you mentioned, being their military wing. Now, if you look carefully at the Angolan South African border war, you will find that you can divide it into three specific phases. The first phase, which I refer to as low-intensity warfare, raged from 1966 until 1975, when we conducted Operation Savannah inside Angola and then came back across the border again. During that stage, we were fighting a counter-insurgency war inside Southwest Africa at low-intensity levels, with the South African police being the leading agency for that. Only after 1975, the SADF took full control of that battle. And then from 1975 until approximately mid-1987, the war started escalating as we started becoming involved more and more with the fighting against the FOPLA, the Cuban forces inside Angola, yeah, which was supported by the Russians and by the Cubans. And then eventually, the last part, the third phase of the war, raged from about September 1987 until 1989, when the battles intensified. I refer to as the high intensity battle phase and also peacemaking, mm-hmm, because that battle was also important in terms of bringing the war to an end. At that stage, perestroika, glasnost was happening, with Gorbachev implementing those reform structures in the Soviet, and we knew that the Iron Curtain it fell in November 1989, if I'm correct. And this allowed the South African government to eventually come to a point where they decided to shed apartheid, release Mandela, and to create a new political dispensation in Africa, in South Africa. That is how important that war was for the creation of peace in Southern Africa. Now, during that era, it was a touch and go situation, or that war would have escalated into a regional war. And fortunately, at that stage, both the Russians and the USA were working very closely together to support the countries who were involved in those battles, such as the Cubans and South Africa and Angolans, to embark on peace mission. And fortunately, the politicians came to their senses during the last high-intensity battles that were fought in the western part of Angola in June 1988, 26, 27 June, last main battles. There was still a MiG attack on one of our positions at Kalawek, very close to the border, where 12 of our guys were killed. And overnight, it was decided from both sides that we should embark on making peace. And a peace agreement was signed. The first peace agreement was signed at Kalawek on the 22nd of August 1988. In actual fact, that was a ceasefire agreement. And then very rapidly after that, on the 22nd of December 1988, the formal agreement, peace agreement, was signed between Angola and South Africa and the Cubans in New York. And that sort of ended the war in Southwest Africa and Angola. And the Cubans, of course, part of the agreement was that the Cubans would withdraw from Angola, and the South African Defense Force will withdraw from Southwest Africa, which was on its way to become Namibia. And that ended the war.
It's an interesting point to note. Modern commentators like to talk about the levels of complexity of modern war, but if you look at the political wars plus the tactics and operations you've just described for the Southern African border war, war seems to always be a bit of a complex beast when you're mixing, you know, soldiers fighting on the ground with politicians fighting in conference rooms.
Absolutely. There was an interesting situation that developed, for example, during one of our operations in August 1982, whilst I was commanding 6-1 Mechanized Battalion, we were conducting high-density counterinsurgency operations deep inside Angola, beyond a town we referred to as Kuvalai, where 11th Brigade of FOPLA was deployed. During one of my briefings at a place called Oshivalo in the northern part of Namibia, the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Minister Pik Botha, and our Chief of the Defence Force, General Jannie Gelnys, gave me an explicit instruction that we should try and avoid head-on contact with FOPLA. And the fight was against SWAPO. We were attacking some of their bases in the region because they were on their way for peace discussions in New York itself. And so I had a very careful instruction from my up as a battalion commander at the lieutenant colonel level not to engage FOPLA at that stage. And that was an era I refer to because that was the influence of politics on a battalion commander who was executing the tactics on the ground. I was talking about fight, fight, talk, talk. One step forward, two step backwards, three steps forward.
Yeah.
Soon after that, we were engaging FOPLA again.
Yeah. It's interesting, and you talked a little bit about the tactics and the imposition of politics on tactics. What were some of the tactics that were used throughout the war from both sides, or all sides?
Well, on the ground, if I look at infantry battalion level, light infantry, for example, and the other forces involved in the counterinsurgency struggle, they were employing counterinsurgency tactics. With other words, patrolling, temporary bases, ambushing, movements, constant movement, operating from temporary bases in the veld, in the bush, was very important. Dominating no man's land, so as to speak, interacting with the local population. It was an ongoing war that happened in northern the northern part of Namibia from 1966 until 1989. And then eventually, as the war escalated, we started establishing units such as 6-1 Mechanized Battalion Group, which became the center of excellence for the development of mobile conventional tactics. But they conducted semi-conventional tactics as well as counter-insurgency operations. You could switch over from the one operation to the other by the flick of a command. We also developed other centers of excellence, such as 3-2 Battalion, which were made up of guerrilla fighters from Angola. It became a South African unit. And that really became the center of excellence for the establishment of unconventional warfare tactics, guerrilla tactics. And then we had other units such as 101 Battalion, which was an indigenous unit, which was made up from the people from Uvambu land, the largest indigenous population in that area. They were also the recruitment base for our enemy, SWAPO, as well as the People's Liberation Army of Namibia. So we established a very strong indigenous core of fighting capabilities that worked in close concert with units, South African first-line fighting units, such as 6-1 Mechanized Battalion. So when you ask me what was your mobile tactics like, it was not truly conventional tactics. It was more in the form of guerrilla tactics, because a unit such as 6-1 MEC could maneuver in the bush around FOPLA units and brigades that were deployed at towns, investing towns as in a defensive mode, and fight a guerrilla war amongst them against our main enemy, which was SWAPO. If I had to summarize the tactics that we refer to now, I would say that in the first place, mobile warfare is like the right and the left arm of a boxer with a singular mind, where you utilize conventional type tactics in a mobile style in close concert with guerrilla fighting. Okay? So you will be able to fight on the front, but you will have guerrilla units deployed in the far out reaches behind the enemy as well. And to us, what was very important in terms of the rigid doctrine followed by, for example, the conventional forces of FOPLA, the Angolans, were taught by the Russians, applying the doctrine of the stepper, rigid command and control systems, rather opting for defense than for offensive movement and large maneuver schemes, was to make the battlefield fluid. In other words, to make it difficult for our enemy to make decisions quickly. So that in the wide open expanse of the African bush, we could fix the enemy forces in terms of time and space, keep them dispersed, whilst at the same time concentrating our forces to attack the enemy defensive positions at different times. Now, when we attacked an enemy brigade, it was normally done with a combat group, which was out of sync with the type of thing that we learn our people and in our colleges, where you should attack with a three against one ratio. We normally did this with 1-3 ratio. Now, of course, we were outgunned in the skies. The Russian mix, eventually in Angola, overshadowed our own frontline fighters because they were more modern. They had front sector missiles, which they could use against our obsolete Mirages. And although we did a lot of ground attacks, and we were fighting outside our radar range. So if we needed to conduct a ground attack, We had to fly under the radar of the enemy. And because of Angola, by that time, Angola had probably become one of the most hostile air defense environments in Africa. We used to do distance bombing from 8 kilometers onto the targets. Yeah. And then artillery, for example, was used in a very offensive manner. We talked about artillery onslaughts, artillery attacks, almost using artillery as an offensive weapon in its own right, as a teeth arm, and as a maneuver force in its own right. During the final battles in southern Angola, we had young artillery officers shadowing the enemy brigades with small protection elements provided by UNITA, the indigenous guerrilla force in Angola. Yeah. And following those units or formations of the enemy, and when they halted, we used to carry out attacks with our artillery and our multiple rocket launcher systems on them, guide the ground attacks against them, and when we had them positions in the right manner, we'll attack them with our ground forces. So we used the bush and night to offset the enemy air capabilities in that sense. So if you ask me mobile warfare, I should say making the battlefield fluid was very important to us, using mobility and firepower to the utmost, fighting deep, with other words, dislocating, disrupting, and preempting the enemy, and of course, protecting yourself by means of natural terrain elements, such as dense bush.
And one of the tools, I suppose, that helped you in your mobile warfare tactics was the Rattal Infantry Combat Vehicle. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that vehicle? Because it's been heralded as quite a robust tool for mobile warfare.
Yeah, the Rattal six-wheeled armored fighting vehicle almost became human to us. You loved it and you touched it and you could smell it, and we lived in it for many years. Now, what's interesting about the Rattal Infantry Combat Vehicle, when the war started intensifying by 1972, we didn't have a mobile conventional capability in the form of armored fighting vehicles such as the Rattal. So it was developed in South Africa. In actual fact, I was still deployed at the infantry school and we were presenting courses with Saracens and Land Rovers armed with brooms to teach the guys mobile tactics. And I received a command from the infantry school commander and from Mayap, the director of infantry, to, as a captain then, to write the user requirements for that vehicle. I did it at 2 o'clock in the morning with pencil still, using pencil. And then we flew to Pretoria, and General Jannie Geldnys was a colonel then. He was the project leader. And we started discussions with regards to that vehicle, started developing the concepts and the prototypes. And by 1973, we were testing the first prototypes. And 1975, it rolled out of Sandok Austral as the first production models. In October 1975, we presented the first course at the infantry school and started developing the doctrine from the ground up. And then in 1976, I was transferred to 1 South African Infantry Battalion in Bloemfontein to set up the training capability for that unit. Then in 1979, the first mechanized infantry battalion, which we refer to as Combat Group Juliet, was deployed into Angola. And then 6-1 Mechanized Battalion Group was established soon after that, and then that unit became one of our major first line fighting units in Angola itself. It was employed as the mobile reserve for the Southwest African Task Force. It was employed in a conventional, semi-conventional role, but also for the conduct of high-intensity counter-insurgency operations. It had amazing bushbreaking capability. Yeah. And we never marched on roads. We went through the bush. Yeah. And you could get situations that we bundubashed, you know, bearing through the bush in Angola during an operation for distances, if you combine the distances traveled, up to 1,600 kilometers for a particular operation, yeah, with a fighting column of about 53 kilometers in length. If you had to travel with a motorbike from the one end to the other end, it will take you 3 hours, 12 kilometers per hour, breaking through the bush. Yeah. And think of the logistics that you had to take with in such an instance. Our unit operated independently in the bush for 10 days. So traveling with us on our logistic vehicles, we were spare engines and spare axles, etc. We could remove a Rattal engine within 20 minutes and replace it within 20 minutes time. If we hit a mine, our technicians could replace that that Axel during the leaguering at night time. And for such operations, we could easily have 12 bunkers of fuel being taken with us during an operation, also including the helicopter fuel that we took with us, because many of our operations were conducted from temporary helicopter bases which we established inside Angola, yeah. and fighting from those bases. Never stationary at one place more than 3 days at a time. Constantly on the move.
Now, Roland, we could sit here all day and chat, but I do know that you've got some other people to see today. So my final question is what we like to call the Butcher's Bill on the Dead Prussian podcast, and it's to emulate big Karl von Clausewitz's quest to define war in as many ways as possible. So each guest gets the opportunity to finish the sentence, war is. So I offer to you, war is.
That's not an easy question to answer, because I can give you a counter answer and ask you, is the taking of Baghdad a good thing to end a war or not? And is shock and awe really the answer to end a war? If you ask me how I see war, I think the purpose of that is to create a better form of peace. And this is something that I'm really proud of. If you think of the South African border war and the struggle that we had in South Africa, when in actual fact the whole world was against us. I think we only had friends in places such as the Middle East, which was Israel, Malawi in Africa, and the Taiwanese in the Far East. And we had to conduct a struggle in our country and at the same time move to a position, a political position, that was suitable for the transformation of our country, where we shedded apartheid and we could free Mandela and change the total political dispensation of our country. So to summarize, war should be used almost as a change management tool to create peace.
That is a new and unique definition for our show. Roland, thank you very much for having a chat with me today. I very much appreciate it. And I also appreciate to listener Mark O'Neill for being able to put me in contact with you whilst you're here in Australia doing your tour. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Mick.
And that was myself and Major General Roland De Vries in the final episode of 2016 for the Dead Prussian podcast. We do have plans to expand the show in 2017, and this will include different format episodes, but we'll keep all that a secret until we release them. We may also have plans where you can show a little bit of fiscal support as well. Until next time, listeners, grab a book and crack on.
Join the conversation with us on Twitter at Dead Prussian Pod, on Facebook at The Dead Prussian page, or on our website www.thedeadprussian.com. All show notes for this episode, as well as copyright information, can be found on the website. The Dead Prussian podcast is written, produced and hosted by Mick Cook. It is co-produced by Amanda Levito. The music used throughout is Caught in the Beat by Broke for Free and is used under a Creative Commons attribution license. All opinions expressed by individuals on the podcast are those of the individual and not necessarily representative of any other organisation.